end of what we've been calling our apologetics or Christian evidence as material. We had a total of 11 lessons on that. But I was forgetting, and maybe my mind was playing tricks on me, that I did have yet another lesson that's kind of the inverse of that, but is related to it. And so tonight we're going to be talking about what are typically referred to as alleged discrepancies in the Bible. We have been looking at all the argumentation, you know, powerful as it is, in favor of the existence of God, the Bible being His Word, Christianity being the truth, and those sorts of things. But this is, like I say, kind of the topsy-turvy, where there are so many arguments that people make that the Bible has failed. And so I thought we really ought to have at least one class, you know, that would address some of that type of information. If you were here last week, you'll remember this photograph of the United States from space and at night, seeing how well lit and electrified that we are. Tonight I thought I'd show you just sort of a companion photo. Now, can you recognize that? You know who that is? It's always shocking to me to realize how heavily populated that Nile River is and how huge that Egypt is. So that's what that is just the very tail end of the Nile River and Egypt. But over here is Israel. And it's really pretty noticeable, again, how that is a very, you know, sophisticated and developed country and much dimmer surrounding it there. But that is Israel out on the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea there, as seen from space and at night. Now, as we start our thoughts for this evening, though, I want to go through a whole series of scriptures that you might want to just jot down that are unusual, I guess, in the New Testament. We're going to save all these from the New Testament. But you would not think that an all-merciful and kind and loving God would make it hard for people to find Him or to serve Him. And yet there are quite a few verses in Scripture that point that out. So I wanted to start with those ideas first, and we'll kind of branch off from that here in just a minute. This is Matthew chapter 7, verses 7 through 11. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, it will be open. Or what man is there among you who, when his son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? There's just a few verses there, and they're short. They all fit easily in pretty large print, you know, on a single slide. Yet how many different ways did he point out in that passage, you have to be energetic, you have to be active, you have to be focused, you're going to have to put out some effort. They're wonderful promises in Matthew, these five verses, but they're all contingent. So many contingencies here. If you do this, then the blessings will come. But it's more than a little obvious. If you refuse to ask or seek or knock, then you've got a problem, because the Lord is guaranteeing that He's going to force Himself upon you, that He's going to thrust Himself, you know, into your life, that you have been given this great gift of free will. And He expects us to avail ourselves of the opportunity. It is wondrous opportunity. It is amazing the things that He gives us in this life and that which is to come. But they require some effort on our part, and they will be kept restricted from those who will not put in that effort. Skipping just to one verse, which is our golden rule, looking further then in verses 13, 14, and 15 in Matthew 7, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Beware the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. And he goes on to develop that thought a little bit, you know, more thoroughly. But here you've got two different ideas in this passage, which again point out the necessity of our effort. The gate is narrow. Few are going to find it. You've got to, you know, make sure that you decide that you want to enter it and you need to seek it out. And while you're doing that, you're going to have to navigate through false prophets as well. There's going to be hindrances and deceptions that will present themselves to human beings. This is a part of life, and God's not going to take it away. It's not going to make it easier for us. He has reasons and purposes in His wisdom that it's better for us, and certainly for His plans, that we struggle a little bit, work at this a little bit. Same gospel, Matthew now, chapter 13, the 6 verses 10 through 15. Disciples came and said to Him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" And the answer, brethren, is not because they're simple illustrations that you'll be able to understand. It's quite the opposite. He says, "To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him shall more be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has, shall be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see, and while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. In their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, 'You will keep on hearing, but will not understand. You will keep on seeing, but will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear, and they've closed their eyes. Otherwise, they would see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their heart and return, and I would heal them.'" Now, that's even stronger than the others, which were of just a general nature, that you're going to have to activate, you know, some interest and some effort to find the truth. But, you know, here he's telling us not everybody's going to find it. And the problem here is not even that they don't have the opportunity, that they haven't heard the words, they don't see what it is that God wants them to do. But the great problem here is that they're dull of heart. That's their fault and their problem. But their heart is dull. It says with their ears they scarcely hear, and it's very active. They have closed their eyes. There's the truth for all to see. And brethren, in the United States of America, who could not find a Bible? Who's never heard of the Bible? In my life as a Christian, stretching back now to 1973, February, I'm pushing up on 42 years now, I met one individual who was unfamiliar with the Bible. A young college kid, I was studying with him about one thing or another, and I said, "Well, thus and such has been going on since Adam and Eve, I guess." I have probably told you this before. And he looked up at me in all honesty. He said, "Who are they?" "Who are Adam and Eve?" He had never heard the name. He had no idea who they were. But apart from the college educated, you know, most people have heard of a Bible. And so, not hard to find. The problem is, they won't listen to it. They won't read it. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I've never known a congregation of saints where you couldn't find probably a goodly number of disciples who've never read the book, have actually waded through all 39 books of the Old Testament and 27 in the New. You know, it takes effort. And even those that have, you know, some kind of interest in it, enough even to attend classes or to come to worship, you know, even fairly regularly, may have dull hearts. Jesus was talking to a whole nation that loved God, thought they were the chosen people of God, and revered their scriptures as giving them special status above everybody else in the world. But with a dull heart, you read it, you don't understand it. You hear it, but you don't get it. You got to work at it. Many people closing their eyes when it's right there in front of them. John 3, verses 20 and 21. "Everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God." Ashley just kind of ran out of time on Sunday, you know, long-winded I am anyway, you know, but you also know how rich that material is, those first 21 verses in John 3 with regard to Nicodemus. And so I didn't even spend a minute on this. We read that particular verse. We didn't deal with it on Sunday. Look, people know, brethren, they have consciences. They've been taught something about morality. And they understand, everybody does, that human beings make mistakes. And some of these mistakes can't just be written off as, oh, that was a mistake. They are crimes. They are evil things that we do. And they know that. But those that still desire to do what is evil because of its carnally satisfying nature, they hate the light. They don't come to the light. They're afraid that people will discover who they really are. And they're embarrassed about it. They ought to be embarrassed about it. But if you practice the truth, you come to the light. You want your deeds to be manifested as having been wrought in God. But that's yet another hurdle that God is putting in front of us, or at least is a part of the natural human being. We're reluctant, you know, to want to be exposed as a failure in any category. So we labor to cover it up. And in so doing, harm ourselves more than anybody else, but wind up, you know, hurting ourselves because we stand back from that truth. Brethren, unless you've got a certain kind of a spirit, a more mature kind of a spirit, an interest in spiritual things, then about every word you read in the Bible is an indictment, isn't it? It's the list of the things that you're not getting done that God would have you do. And that's hard to read. And so many times people turn away from it. John chapter 6, verses 60, and then skipping to 66 and 67, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, "This is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it?" And as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So Jesus said to the 12, "You do not want to go away also, do you?" Yes, it was a difficult statement. And that's just the simple fact of the matter. Jesus presents things that are difficult. Jesus presents things that are advanced. Jesus presents things that require a lot of effort to understand. I preached a lesson on Sunday morning about Nicodemus not being able to understand. I've come across that verse quite a few times in my 40 years of preaching, and never yet have I floated that idea that I didn't get a letter or comment from somebody, you know, if they didn't think that was so. You can't rebuke a guy, you know, unless he could have understood that. And I appreciate that. You know, really, I'm not even all that opposed to it. It's mostly a matter of semantics, I think. But the fact of the matter is, Jesus does not present pablum every time he opens up his mouth. He is not, going to gum our vegetables for us. Brethren, sometimes you just got to belly up to the table, get out a knife and fork, and start carving on the meat. It is difficult. It was difficult. There's tough stuff out there. There's not a lot of it. You are not going to get the first time. And you might want to give up. And many people do. And what did we see 2 weeks ago in John 6? Jesus never, backs away from any of that and starts begging and pleading and breaking it down, into baby food for everybody. It's a difficult statement. You're going to stay or go? You're going to get with the program or not? What are you going to do now, soldier? The drill sergeant shouts in your face, and it's decision time. Yeah, it's tough. What are you going to do? A bunch of them quit. But the Lord's not going to, add milk to the mix. John chapter 7. That's an interesting verse, 17 through 11. It's supposed to be verse 17 and no through 11. I am always copying and pasting, so sometimes I forget to erase. If anyone is willing to do his will, he will know the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak from myself. Brethren, this is the reason why people don't believe the Bible. Because they're not willing to believe the Bible. So with great shows of how intelligent they are, and how open-minded they are, and how serious, you know, their research is, and all the rest of that, they never come to the knowledge of the truth, because for all that blowing and going about how, you know, smart and energetic they are in the pursuit of the truth, they don't want to hear it. And most of the time, they're putting up objections that are not actually questions. They're building walls rather than asking what is the truth of the matter. The last of these verses is, I think, the strongest, most amazing of all of them. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 8 through 12, the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness, for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence, so that they will believe what is false, in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. God himself provides opportunity to be misled, opportunities which will mislead those who have never received the love of the truth. Now please, in that verse, don't ever blame God. Well, God never gave them the love of the truth. The love of the truth was always available, but they rejected it. They decided not to love the truth. The love of the truth is not in them because they have dull hearts and they close their eyes and their ears. They're resisting this because they don't want to come to the light, and they're looking in for rationalizations, excuses, and reasons to avoid that light. And God himself, not to mention Satan, will provide plenty of those deluding influences so that they can believe what is false. They'll be judged. They will not be saved because they didn't believe the truth. They were taking pleasure, last line there, in wickedness. Mike.
I always wondered about that, this verse, and wonder if what you're saying, I've always wondered if it's that God, the way he loves everyone, even people that want to do this, and he provides even a haven for them, that he's not going to have, this verse just, it confuses me. So if that's what it is, he's giving them a place to be themselves.
See, I love what I see in you right now. You're having this visceral reaction. You said, you know, that is not confusing. You know, Gator Will Robinson. And you're right. That's the response you know, I have. Because God is love. It is God. And he is compassion. And what price did he pay to save you? His own son. Why would he not want anybody to come to the truth? What's the answer to that question? He doesn't want anybody to not come to the truth. Maybe it's written that one. He doesn't want that. He wants everybody to be saved. Okay? But, brethren, there's a program, and it only works one way. It works the same way for everybody. So, unless you are willing to do his will, John 7:17-11. Unless you're willing to do that, see, you're never going to come to the knowledge of the truth. And so, God permits these problems. Okay? Now, what by the way, how many of you been in the military? Okay. Boot camp. Obstacle courses. Why? What's the point?
To get rid of the people that don't
want to
be.
Exactly. See? And to do what to those who are willing?
To motivate,
to build up, you know, they come to success. But the ones that aren't willing will be revealed. And washed out. Okay? I spent 3 months in Ranger training, Special Forces training. So a lot of guys get washed out. And I was one of them. Okay. Okay. And so I finished the course, but also failed it. So I never became a Ranger.
I had airborne, though. Got through that part.
Okay. But the Army was infinitely better for my washing out. It was in their best interest. It was in my best interest. I wasn't cut out for that kind of stuff.
You know, I freely admit it. I just didn't have what it takes. So, not everybody does. Find what you're supposed to do. In the meantime, that's what God is doing.
He is sifting. He is weeding. He is also building up, working, so that those who are unwilling, unable, for whatever reason, why the rest is built up. Yes, yeah, comment?
Who is the one who's coming in that accords with
the next question?
Bill, I just can't. It's 2 Thessalonians 2. So one of these days we'll get there. I'm not even gonna start. Come see me after. Come see me tomorrow. We'll talk about it between 12 and 2.
After that, you're on your own. Okay. Just this morning, brethren, I get a call from my younger son. He's 33 years old. And he said this, "Dad, what's the deal with dinosaurs on the ark?" Okay. Why do people ask that question? Why do people usually bring up dinosaurs on the ark? Were they or weren't they? Pardon me? Usually they're putting up some kind of an argument that the Bible can't be true, dinosaurs are too big, and all this kind of stuff. So my son and I talked about it, at some length this morning. I explained to him, for all the people trying to do with the dinosaurs to prove, that there never was an ark, and that Noah never, built it, got on it, or got off of it, the dinosaurs didn't have a thing in the world to do with it. Species have been dying off and becoming extinct, very many of them, and every year, for thousands of years. It is very common before Americans, started creating smog. It's just natural order. So maybe all the dinosaurs, the real big ones or whatever, died off in a comet, impact or something, before the ark. I don't know. But maybe they were infants, not full grown, on the ark as well. And either way, what difference does it make? God got all the animals on the ark that he wanted, and he's just smart enough to build a boat big enough to hold the ones that he wanted. That's what, happened. But mostly, this is evidence of that hard heart and the dull heart and the closed eyes and ears. People are just looking for some justification to not come to the light. The dinosaurs are not the least bit of a problem, brethren, at all. And I directed him, by the way, at Don Patton. Most everybody here knows him. And he said, "Wow, Dad, I never heard about those videos." I know you were a little kid when I filmed those lessons, and I had to drive an hour and a half each way to get them, so I left you guys at home. You were just kids then, but I got the videos. And so, I have to send you some. He said, "Yeah, I want to watch those." Great. What he wants is to be able now to answer an argument. This is the inverse part of apologetics. He wants to be able to have a response when the unbeliever, throws something at him. That's what we're going to do for the last half of this class, is accept that God is the ultimate drill sergeant. He wants you to survive. He wants you to succeed. Drill sergeants are pulling for you. They really are. But they're there to make you measure up. And so is God. Now then, if you've got what it takes, then there's plenty of evidence and answers for the infidel that are just insuperable difficulties for them. Give them the answer,
And they'll run away and hide under their rock anyway because they're not willing to come to the truth. Did you hear
me? Yeah, I did. You talking about that, a light just went off in my head. It never occurred to me before. Maybe that's how the dinosaurs became extinct, that they didn't get on the ark. I mean,
well, they didn't die in the flood. They're air breathing. And God saved, two of each and seven some. So if they're alive at that time, they got on the ark. Come off the ark, you know what I mean? But they may have become extinct before the ark was ever built.
Yeah.
And so we have, bones now, but when did they die in relation to the ark? So anyway, it's not that I want to address tonight. It's just to say that from the time that people start going to school, and particularly when they hit college, they're going to have, the erudite professor tell them, the Bible is full of contradictions. Now they start with trying to Bible contradict, natural law. There we go, Bill Nye, the whole debate that we watched, three nights of that. So, we got all of that. I'm not going to deal with any of those kinds of discrepancies that have to do with the discrepancy between what God said and what man thinks he knows better, in the realm of science. But not every scientist, is some kind of a nutcase either. They usually come in packages like this. Here's Neil deGrasse Tyson, a very intelligent guy, very personable kind of a guy. I struggled through more than half of this last edition of Cosmos because I felt I owed it to the world and to God and to myself to understand something about what is the current, enemy doing as they try to oppose Christianity, and especially God in the Bible. And that's what the latest Cosmos thing was all about. It was 13 episodes, and it was just grueling. I mean, about halfway through, it was just horrible. But the guy is very persuasive, and he's extremely intelligent, terrific, media figure, and all the rest of that. They're powerful. We need to be able, brethren, to show that the power is only in the presentation and not in the evidence or the subject matter at all. But the guys of today are not the least bit new. Here's a couple of old books. This one was printed in 1891. This one you read easier. 100 Contradictions in the Bible. Guys have been doing this, for as long as there have been people, I guess, trying to argue against God. Now, my favorite review of the new Exodus movie, I mean, I've told you this already, too. I thought it was just great. Exodus, Gods and Kings. In the review said, don't let your people go to this movie. It was just that bad. And what they did, they got, the best subject matter you can imagine for special effects movie is the 10 plagues. Bill and I went together, and what did we see? We saw all of them that they tried to argue away as taking place naturalistically. That they were just unusual events in nature, but not miracles at all. And that's the kind of thing these books will do too, There's contradictions. But these books, particularly, first one's about scientific and literary Bible difficulties, but this one is in the Bible. And that alone is what we're going to talk about tonight. Where it is contended by these people that the Bible contradicts itself, and that makes it the ultimate foolishness. That if you will read it, you'll find out that frequently, innumerable times, they'll say, it contradicts itself. It is not consistent even in its own writing. Now that would be, if provable, a pretty powerful charge. That's important. The Bible must be consistent. The Bible must not argue against itself. The Bible can't contradict itself and be the truth. You can't have opposite things both be true at the same time. So we need to work with that. Now, I'd like to introduce you just to this book. It's one of my favorites, and here's my copy, right here, which in the margin I noted I bought in January of 1975. I put my name in the month and year of every, in every book I buy. And so here I am. I'm about to turn 1975, next month, 4 years I've owned this book. 4 years. When was it first printing? 101 years before I bought it.
I bought it in 1975, was 101 years older, you know, than that, or at the time, and now we've got, you know, 40 more years. It's a classic, and it's just the most wonderful resource, because the professors at school are going to give everybody, you know, a handful of contradictions, and they go, the Bible's no good. And then, not having the love of the truth, they'll never go to investigate. They'll just parrot those things, you know, in the future. A book like this, brethren, this one in the back, has got 19 pages that look like those two. And all those are is a Bible reference and a page number, where supposedly that Bible reference is a part of a contradiction, a self-contradictory, you know, statement in Scripture. So if somebody comes to you with any given, you know, argument and any given verse, I just, okay, give me a minute. You know, may not know the answer off the top of my head, but, you know, look it up. And then he'll explain to you, you know, more evidence will be presented as to why it is that these arguments are so fallacious. Now, let's just plunge into a couple of them, you know, quickly here tonight. But if you open your Bibles, please, to Jeremiah chapter 32. Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 27 has something to say about God's omnipotence. That is, about his all power, his entire power. Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 27 says, "Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is anything too difficult for me?" Well, it's a rhetorical question, and the answer then would be no. Nothing is too difficult for God. If you come to Matthew, you'll find the New Testament says a very similar thing. The Gospel of Matthew at chapter 19, and here at verse 26. "Looking upon them, Jesus said to them, 'With men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible.'" Okay? Now then, look at Hebrews chapter 6. "If all things are possible, there isn't anything that's too difficult for God." Let's go to Hebrews 6, the chapter that we studied at two Sunday nights ago. And in chapter 6, at verse 18, there, it break into a sentence, but two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie. Well, if nothing's too difficult and he can do all things, can he tell a lie? I mean, even we can tell lies. Raise your hand if you ever told a lie. See, those of you hands down, a bunch of liars. Even human beings can tell lies. You don't have to be powerful for that. You know, but God can't. Says he can. Isn't that just a glaring contradiction in Scripture? And wouldn't you just be such the fool to believe it? By the way, one of the Vermet boys, and I can't remember which one it is, because 2.5 years later and I still can't tell them apart. Yeah, Brandon or something. So, one of them came up to me a couple of weeks ago and he said, "Hey," he said, "I got this at school," I think it was, you know, he said, if God can do all things, then can he create a rock that he cannot lift?" Now, brethren, for people who like to reason in circles, you know, that sounds like something. I'm not accusing Evan of anything. He thought it was curious. He wanted to know how he was going to respond to it, you know. Well, how do you respond to that? If God is all powerful, then can he make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift? If he can do all things, and he can't lie, then he can't do all things. It's just nonsense to be reading the Bible. What do you say?
Because it's not his nature.
Yes.
It's not his nature to lie.
See, this is exactly the answer. God can do all things which are not sinful or stupid or absurd or self-contradictory or contrary to his character, as the one that was just sounded out.
God can do all things that are reasonable and useful. He still is a reasonable and intelligent being. And so, he does not play such games. Can God make a two-legged tripod? See, all you're doing is playing with words, and it's absurd, and it's self-contradictory. And what it is a desperate effort to avoid the truth that they know is right there in their faces. God can do all things. It is understood, brethren, that God does not do that which is contrary to His nature or to His character. He can do all things that ought to be done. Okay? And that's understood, and it's the kind of thing that anybody in a right mind, I think, understands. In any other book that they've ever read, desperate to avoid the Bible, they won't allow that obvious fact for the Bible itself. Now, let's talk about God's omniscience. It's a fancy way of saying that He's all-knowing. Psalm 139, which is one of everybody's favorites. I just guess you couldn't ask people to make a list of five psalms that they like the best and not get 139 on the list. But, 24 verses, we're just going to look at the first few. O Lord, You have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You know my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down. You're intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there's a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, You know it all. Fine. But what happened in Genesis chapter 22? This is one of the favorites, by the way, that you'll have people throw up at you. And so these are not really, esoteric or arcane kind of stuff. These are the ones that you get hit with. And so in Genesis 22, and in verse 12, He said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Well, if He knows all things, how come Genesis admits that He didn't know what Abraham was going to do? It's a contradiction, isn't it? What are you going to do, soldier? What are you going to do? Yeah, on the most elemental level, on the surface, looks like a contradiction. But is it really a contradiction? What do you say?
So we'll just take Michael's answer there because he's getting, right at it. Brother, God works with us like any good teacher works with his students. Now, what I'm about to put up on the screen is just a simple paragraph. And what we're going to see is a raging, flaming contradiction in a college professor who must therefore necessarily be fired immediately and banished from America and the halls of academia. Because he would do such a thing as grievous as this. Well, suppose a teacher in college stands up before his students and he says, "I will now pour acid into this mixture to find out what will happen." He pours the acid in and then he says, "I now know thus and such about how these substances interact." Could a professor say that in front of a class? Remember what Michael said, because he was right. The man is putting himself in the place of the student, and he is explaining what he's doing. Sure, he knows what's going to happen. Why is he up there? He's not doing that. He knows it's in the course book. He knows what's going to happen. Well, exactly what's going to happen. But he says, "I will now pour acid into the mixture to find out what will happen." For them to find out what will happen. He knows what's going to happen. See? And then he says, now he says, "We now know," or "I now know." It's an artifice in language.
It is a grammatical construction, you know? It's an idiom. It's a way of teaching. And it's used every day by all kinds of people. You bunch of liars, you, every one of them did that with your kids. You did it constantly. Let's go out and see what, did you name what it is? Let's go out and see if there's, you know, insects with lots of legs. You don't have a clue, right? Whoa, what do you know? There are. What do you call that? And the kid looks on the desk, a centipede. Didn't you never go to school? See, you know, but what are you doing with your students? You're leading them along. You're bringing them along, and you're using their language, and you're putting yourself in their place. In that manner, you're involving them. It's an artifice that we use all the time. But as an artifice, it's not, you know, a thing that is evil or deceptive or a failure. It's just an artful way to teach. And we do it all the time when nobody gets upset. Okay? These are the kinds of things, brethren, that folks throw up, you know, all the time. And it just, in the end, it's really sad and it's frustrating, you know, that people could be so silly. They just never spent, you know, 5 or 10 minutes thinking about it. Certainly never bought a book, you know, to look into the topic. They weren't interested. They didn't have the love of the truth. Now, let's talk about God's omnipresence. And these were just simple, you know, collection of omnis. He's everywhere, isn't he? What does Amos chapter 9 say? Okay, Amos chapter 9 and first, second and third verses. 9:2. Though they dig into Sheol, from there shall my hand take them. And though they ascend to heaven, from there will I bring them down. And though they hide on the summit of Carmel, I will search them out and take them from there. And though they conceal themselves from my sight on the floor of the sea, from there I will command the serpent, and it will bite them. God's everywhere. He knows all things because he's everywhere. He has omniscience because he has omnipresence. But what do you get in the very third chapter of Genesis? Okay? Here, Amos has been going on and on and on about how you can't hide from God. And we only get 3 chapters deep into the book. In verse 8, it says, they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. God's going, huh, I wonder where they are. Adam! I'm getting tired. I guess I'll go home. Can't find Adam. Did he know where Adam and Eve were?
Sure.
Of course he knew where Adam and Eve were. He always knew where they were. Now, what say you? What are you going to do with this? God says he's everywhere. You can't hide from me in Amos. And then Adam and Eve hid from him. What's the answer to this obvious contradiction? Okay, I'm going to quit preaching. It's an insuperable difficulty. Look, I played hide and seek a week ago tomorrow with my grandkids. Okay? Now, I'm out there in the house. Yeah, I know where the kid is. I can hear him giggling 2 doors down. So I say, where are the kids? Oh, Sophie, I can't find her. You know, and I know she's right there. Okay? Am I actually ignorant?
No.
And once again, what am I doing? See, I'm accommodating myself to this. But this one has yet another layer. Look carefully at the verse. And what does it actually say? Adam and Eve, all of it is couched in what they were thinking and what they were doing. Adam and Eve hid. Do you none of you know where I am? I'm hiding. See how desperate this is, brethren? How pathetic this kind of stuff is? If you just rub a few brain cells together and think about it for a minute, well, not one alleged discrepancy that has ever been floated has any, where's the beef in it? Then none of them do. And I mean, it gets to the point, brethren, where you know something. You know they don't want it. They do not want it. Asa, here in 2 Chronicles, now this is not one of the, you know, biggies, but come over to 2 Chronicles, I mean, it's an easy one to see the apparent contradiction, so I used it. In 2 Chronicles, chapter 14. So here's verse 3. Verse 2. Asa did good and right in the sight of the Lord his God, and he removed the foreign altars and the high places. He tore down the sacred pillars. He cut down the Asherim and commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers and to observe the law and the commandment. He also removed the high places and the incense altars from all the cities of Judah, and the kingdom was undisturbed under him. So he's cleaning house, isn't he? Yes. But you turn back a couple of books to 1 Kings chapter 15, and in 1 Kings 15, he's talking about the same guy. And it says there in verse 14, the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. 2 Chronicles says they were all taken away, and 1 Kings says they weren't. What are you going to do, soldier? I heard a noise, but I didn't.
All of them weren't taken away. Some of them were, and some of them weren't taken.
See, it's as simple as that, isn't it? Asa destroyed the high places at one point in his life. What, did the guy only live 24 hours? But he let them stand at a different time in his life. That's one answer. By the way, tonight I've only given you one answer. Well, I did, I guess the one I'm going to give you two. But, you know, in most cases, there's two, three, four, five, six. You know, you've got all kinds of strings of potential answers there. Sometimes you've got so many to pick from, you don't even know which one's the actual right one. One says he didn't, one says he did. That's right. So does it have to be exactly the same moment in time? No. But here's something else to think about. Here's a second answer to this. This would have required, though, that somebody had been a Bible student. Did they care? See? And that is, high places that were built in honor of whom? I couldn't hear, but Jehovah God. Okay? Now, that one gets a little bit thornier, but it still allows that there may have been locations that were called high places, not devoted to an idol, which God would allow. And that high place, Asa would do what with? To be ungrammatical. With what? With Asa, you know, whatever is grammatical. He let them stand. See? But very few people are going to dig enough back in those Old Testament historical books to find out that high places were used in more than one way. Okay? Which would allow maybe some more art. So, again, there's just depth and depth to these answers if anybody has a mind to try and, you know, and understand them. Let's take another 1 Chronicles. Here in 2 Chronicles, back up a few pages to 1 Chronicles chapter 10. In the 10th chapter, 1 Chronicles, and down at verse 6. Saul died with his three sons, and all those of his house died together. Saul died with his three sons and all of his house. Right? Is that hard to understand? Saul died with his three sons and all those of his house died together. See? Now you back up a few books this time to 2 Samuel. And when you get to 2 Samuel chapter 2, speaking of the exact same event in a separate book, 2 Samuel 2 in verse 8 says, "But Abner the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim." Well, he's supposed to be dead at this point,
Because the three sons and all of his household died in their Ishbosheth. It's just, you know, the Bible is just such junk, isn't it? I mean, it's just so wretched it can't even figure out how to keep its own back straight. I mean, if it's only one king, how many sons can he have? What case counts for? You know, anybody can see that the Bible is just riddled with foolish superstition. And anybody that believes in that is just some kind of really sad character. What say you? Well, Jude's on a roll tonight, isn't he? He's carrying the ball all night long, you know, score another one. Well, sure. How many of Saul's sons and of his house died on that day in that battle? Everyone that was there. Was Ishbosheth there? No. So he didn't die. He wasn't there. See, again, I'll just take just a moment to go, oh, wait a minute. You know, is this speaking in some sort of absolute and universal terms that will not allow any exception of any conceivable kind? Especially in the light of evidence, which says there are exceptions, like Ishbosheth, who wasn't there. Okay, so Saul and his sons, three of them, and all the house that was with him, kicked the bucket pretty violently on that day. All the king's house who were at the battle died. Okay? Now, there's 19 pages of verses in Halley's alleged discrepancy. That's not Homer Haley, that's Halley. Homer didn't live in the 1800s, obviously. Okay. So, here's the deal, brothers. You can do this all night and next week and week after that, week after that, week after that. But I got the book. So the next time somebody hits you with it, tell me what the verse is, I'll look it up in the index, and I'll tell you what the answer is. Now, one last thought. Do I have to know the answer to every one of thousands of alleged discrepancies that have been posited since the history of man in order for the Bible to be true? No. I haven't heard of the great majority of them yet. Okay? But you send it to me, and I'll give you the answer. It's there to be found. I can't hear you, Greg.
There's also the Skeptic's Annotated Bible online.
Oh, is that? Yeah, right. The Skeptic's Annotated Bible would just be full of these.
It'll give you the contradiction, but it also gives the rebuttal.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, you can get this material online, you know, in a thousand different places, too. The Internet's a wonderful thing, brother. It really is. It's astonishing what you can find out there, you know, in the answer to your question. All you got to do is just ask the question, and Google's there for you. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay, you see what I mean is this is kind of the inverse of Christian evidences. It's not like these are evidences to prove God exists, but it's just to answer the sort of fallacious reasoning and sophistry that people put up, you know, the straw men and silliness to try and argue against the Bible. Brethren, you can just trample those things all day long. There's not one of them ever that had any steam in it. Not one. Okay? Comment or question?